Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Lucy Bryden. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
And we've come to talk about your film Body of Water, which is your first feature and is available widely on all digital platforms to rent and buy, and is now coming to Sky Movies in May, you said?
Yes, I think it's May. Should be May.
Okay. Yeah. And before we go into details, do you want to give us a brief synopsis to what Body of Water is about?
Sure. Body of Water follows Stephanie, who's a war photographer, and she comes out of rehab for chronic anorexia in the run-up to her mother's wedding. And she's trying to reconnect with her family, but mostly her teenage daughter Pearl, who she's become estranged from. So it sort of follows the lead up to the wedding and the stresses and strains on those relationships.
What for you was the kernel of the idea that led to the film we see today?
Well, I had issues of eating for pretty much my entire 20s, and it varied from like anorexia to sort of it wasn't even bulimia. It was just sort of very, very strange patterns around food. I was very unhealthy for quite a long time, and also just sort of became quite detached from my friends and my family. And I was going through a lot in personally at that time. Like, my parents were getting divorced and it was really messy and all this sort of thing. So, and I was living in China, and I was I was pretty wild as well. So it's like, you know, doing a lot of cool stuff, but then just, I think that was one of my ways of coping with it. And also just keeping some semblance of control when all else felt like, that's what it's about, really. So there was that. And also I'd seen other people in my family, older women, have this problem, not to the point where they were in a clinic, and I was never in a clinic either, but to the point where it's severely affecting their lives, but they wouldn't do anything about it. And I, you know, kind of got over it and I'm totally fine now, but pretty much, but like, I'd seen obviously members of my family, as I say, live with this thing their whole life. And I was like, well, that happens a lot. And the more I talked about it with people, mostly anecdotally with friends, the more I kind of saw that, yeah, okay, this is something that, and also it's not just women, it's men as well, and, you know, other gender identities. But, you know, so it's something that I think has been particularly pigeonholed as being a problem of a certain demographic, and that you get, and then you get over it and that's it. It's not, it's so much more complicated than that, and it's so much more delicate. And that's why, you know, when I started out this project, it actually started life as a short film. And the short film was about the Stephanie character, this woman in her 30s, and her daughter, who was at that point a lot younger than the final character of Pearl, had made her birthday cake and she couldn't eat it. And it was just about that moment where, you know, she's trying to do this thing because it's a sign of love, but she can't follow through with it. So that was the sort of genesis of it. And then from that, I thought, oh, you know, there was so much more to unpick. So that it expanded, and then it became a feature script. And then it was selected by Film London for development. So that was sort of how it progressed in the really early stages.
I was going to say, so in terms of then taking that forward as a feature idea as opposed to a show, what and given you were drawing on your own life experiences as much as anything else, as much as sort of seeing what wasn't being done in the media in terms of the way it was portrayed, what for you then became the storytelling challenges during the script development phase?
So I wrote a draft, and then it was very early draft that I had written. We sent into to Film London, and then they picked it up, and then they developed it. So we had kind of quite high level input from a really quite an early stage in the development process, which was good. But all the time, I think there was a lot of, understandable anxiety around how it's that fine line between you want to explore something authentically that's complicated and challenging, but you don't want to trigger. You're not trying to like push people down a spiral again. Like, so you don't want to trigger off people that have had these experiences. So there's all this sort of complexities going into it. I would say that was a huge challenge. And going into it, I had to talk about how I was going to portray this in a sensitive way many, many times. And that was completely understandable, as I say. But to the point where I was like talking about how I wanted to shoot it, and always I'd envisaged it the way it came out, which was sort of very stripped back, but not in her face at all for the most part. Just letting it sort of play out, and not, not sort of, I guess, fetishizing or exploiting or being too, glamorizing it really.
No. I mean, I think one of the brilliant things about your film is that it's almost like it's just you. And this isn't to downplay it at all. This is like you use it as an obstacle in her life to what she wants, which is obviously a relationship with her daughter and a relationship with her mother that functions somewhere along the normal spectrum. But there's this thing that she doesn't control that rears its head whenever she gets. It's almost like. She takes the one step forward and three back. It's always like that seems to, and I thought that was it was like a rhythm of the film. It felt like watching.
Yeah, that's a really important point, and it does have a very kind of specific rhythm, and it's quite an uncomfortable rhythm. And I think we're kind of forced into a position of like the way it's shot does put you in this place of watching her, and the three scenes where she's eating are intentionally like really long. They're really kind of uncomfortable. And I think it's just sort of trying to sort of say, you know, this is what it's like to live with this. And it's not vanity. It's not. And I think that's something a lot of people don't quite understand, is that it's not about vanity. It's not about saying about, you know, you're beautiful or not. It's so much more layered than that. That was tough. And then the other challenge was, just sort of making sure that it was sort of explored. I'd done enough research, because obviously I'm drawing on my own experiences, but that's not universal. So there was a lot of that went into it. But I think that paid off in the end.
Outside of your own experience then, what did you find that it was important for you to learn about eating disorders that helped you portray it the best you could?
My experience sort of felt, after I dug more deeply and I went and had a lot of, I went to visit a particular clinic. They were very kindly let me visit. And that was, not an NHS clinic. That was a private clinic. The NHS clinics wouldn't let me go. Obviously they let, people like, Louis Theroux go, but they didn't let me go. So I went to one, and there was one particular person I spoke to she was the same age as me at the time. So she was about 32, and she'd been going in and out of this place, not this place specifically, but out of these sort of places since she was 16. And so she spent most of her, like pretty much all of her adult life in that way. And it was so tragic. And her body was so ravaged. I think it was just the fact that we were the same age and I'd done so many things despite having everyone's got their shit, you know, especially in your 20s. But like, you know, I was so shocked and saddened by her that I was like, oh yeah, this is what it's like when I looked in her in the eye and I thought, you know, you're never going to get over this, are you? Because you don't, this is all you know. And that to me was incredibly moving. And so that was something that when I left that day, I was really kind of like really thinking about it a lot afterwards and how, yeah, not everyone gets to get over it. And that's a huge part of recovery. And nobody really likes to talk about that. And the narratives that were fed are you know, a particular kind of, yeah, this, you know, everyone kind of gets their second chance or they can, you know, put it to bed. And hopefully, yes, but failure is a huge part of it.
I mean, because I must admit, I mean, just in terms of learning stuff, watching your film, I wasn't familiar with the idea of rehab in the sense of like I'd imagine alcoholism or drug addiction being treated. That was certainly an eye opener for me watching the film.
Yeah,
and then that plays into what you just described there about that young woman's experience is that you don't all get to be distanced from the thing that's causing you problems.
And it does have all these complicated, and it's also just like family relationships. It can't not affect them. And this woman, the woman in the clinic's mum, had obviously been through it all with her from the very beginning. And, you know, how difficult for her to look at her daughter and just think, you know, she's never really got, she's probably never gone on holiday. You know, she's never done a lot of normal things. And it's, yeah, I just felt, and that I think was also like, you know, as much as the secondary characters in Body of Water are complicated and not necessarily, you don't always sympathize with them. But I think certainly Stephanie's mother, I know she's quite a contentious character, but that's intentional because she's just sort of at her wit's end. And if you can imagine living, you know, having to deal with this and also looking after your daughter's daughter and just perhaps feeling like, when do I get a chance to just sort of live? And, you know, that I think is kind of, it's a real feeling and you kind of, as complicated as it is, I think it was, you know, that's what is her character's doing in the story is sort of dealing with all those feelings.
Yeah, no, it felt like the mother is almost like in treatment by proxy, you know, because she's doing all the ancillary living that the mother isn't able to do because she's in and out of rehab, and therefore the daughter becomes the grandmother's responsibility, which then means she's just continuing being a mother like into infinity almost. And I guess that must, I guess when you've had the empty nest syndrome when the daughter would have left originally, you know, and was getting on with her life, this wasn't part of phase B of being an adult. Shambrook Plain, Stephanie, is since I've watched your film, I watched The Terror on BBC, and I have to say she's a bloody chameleon because I didn't spot it was her till after the fact. I was like, this is amazing. I didn't realize I watched the same actor. So, you know, props to her on that front, that idea of being able to just be invisible in plain sight while being a character at the same time. But in terms of that role and Shambrook taking it on, what for you did she bring to the performance that maybe wasn't on the page and was sort of so pleasing for you as the director?
First off, I have to agree, she's such a chameleon. And actually, I spoke to my dad the other day and he was like, I think I saw Shambrook, who was in your film on The Terror. And he did the same thing. He was like, I wasn't sure if it was her until the end. And I was like, that's why she's so amazing.
I was like doing the, you know, the classic check on the phone. Like, oh my God, it is.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Shan's just the best. She is the best kind of actor because she just is so committed. She's really, she's so smart. And she wants to know this person better than I do. And so we'd have a lot of quite in-depth conversations for her to get a sense of who Stephanie was and her background. And we both, you know, read certain books about war, you know, biographies of war photographers and things like that. And she really got her teeth into it. But I guess, you know, that role and that the film as a whole, it could have quite easily been, I didn't want it to be a sort of constant, likely hysteric level of emotional turmoil, because nobody particularly wants to sit and watch that, right? I know Body of Water is a tough film, but it's not, there are a lot of, it operates on quite a, largely quite a subtle register. There are obviously higher key moments and so on, of, you know, that's just inevitable. There's a range. But I'm all about kind of trying to be understated and trying not to, and it was about letting like the moments between lines of dialogue and letting these moments linger, which is what so much, well, one of human interaction, but just obviously moments in families are like, there's so much that's unsaid. And a lot of the moments when they're eating together and they're all kind of watching what Stephanie eats sort of surreptitiously. And because there's several scenes where that happens. But yeah, to go back to Shan specifically, yeah, she was so committed. She wanted to do all the work, and she obviously, you know, trained and went on a diet regime to, she lost about 30 pounds, I think, to play the role. And that was tough. You know, that's really tough. That's really challenging in a lot of ways. But she wanted to do it, you know, right. And she wanted to do it authentically. And that was a huge asset to the production, because it wouldn't have worked as well, I don't think, anywhere near as well, if she hadn't been in it, to be honest.
How do you factor something like that into it? Is that something you're saying at the top end, you know, you're going to have to lose weight? Or is this a conversation you have about what the role will be and will you lose weight?
Yeah. I mean, it was tough because, you know, it's a kind of, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs kind of scenario.
Yeah.
So obviously and earlier on in development, it wasn't actually even one of the developers. It was a friend said, do you not think it'd be better making a film about a character that's got bulimia? Because at least then it's not particularly tied to a certain look. And I was just adamant that it had to be this because it was the thing I want, you know. And it was, you know, talking to actresses about it. There were a couple of great actresses that wanted to do it but weren't prepared to sort of lose weight or anything. And so I did find myself in this weird position of being like, well, you kind of have to for this role because it's what it's about. And obviously that kind of goes against a lot of my instincts as a woman that's had these problems and as a director in the 21st century. You don't want to be going to someone saying, but I think a lot of my nervousness around that was also like, I wondered if I would have behaved the same if I'd been talking about a man's body. And then I think that made me feel better about it, because it's like when Christian Bale did like The Machinist,
no
one polices that in the same way. But with a woman's body, like everyone got a say in like, well, should you be asking her to do this? And it's like, well, she's still a professional. She, you know, she wants to do it.
Yeah.
It's a challenge for her. We're not triggering anything that we, you know, she's never had any issues with food. So she was a safe, like, and she was fine, and she sort of put it on and took it off like a hat, really. But we had to be careful in the casting process about who we worked with, because we knew the potential that if they had had a problem like this before, it might trigger something off again. And yeah, obviously, yeah, yeah. No film is worth that. So So yeah, there was a lot of thought and conversation that went into it. And during her sort of training period, she was she worked with a nutritionist and a trainer and a therapist, and they all kind of just to sort of give her the support that she needed. So I think she found that great, but I know that she had, you know, and she had to think quite carefully about whether she could do it as well in the end. Obviously she did. So
I guess the difference between Body of Water and the Machinist is the Machinist is a kind of a man who's literally decomposing because of the life he leads. It's not about the eating disorder, and you're addressing the subject direct and asking someone to commit to something that is the eating is equivalent. It could be seen as the equivalent.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah,
but I'd never thought about it until you said it actually, because yeah, when the Machinist was being made, it was all, oh, he's smoking 20 fags and running 6 miles a day. That's how he's losing weight, and it was all big heroics. It wasn't, oh, we're worried about his mental state and will he ever recover from this and will it trigger? It was never that. The PR tale was never that at all, was it?
No.
Yeah, it's interesting that.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Indeed. So you said to yourself about leaving the gaps and stuff, and I think that's always the great sign of a good drama, is where you feel like the family have had these conversations before, so they don't need to have them again. So silence does happen, and that's a sign of people knowing each other, for good or bad, no matter how they feel about each other. If you've said it 100 times, then just because you're pointing the camera at them at this point, they won't necessarily want to be saying it again in that moment of the film. I mean, it must be difficult that in terms of, you know, wanting to, I mean, you always want the audience to get what they see as opposed to get what they get told all the time. How did you find that? Did some dialogue get lost in the production itself, like where you realised it just wasn't needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of scenes, obviously, that got chopped. Things get rearranged, things get chopped, and quite a lot of the dialogue got not that much, but a reasonable amount. I think I'd been had quite a judicious dialogue trim before the final draft was shared with actors at all.
Okay.
I think it strikes quite a good balance. I mean, there's obviously things I would do differently now, but it was my first feature, so.
No. It breathes.
No.
You're going to say it breathes
no,
lovely.
No, it's just, oh, thank you. But yeah, I think I always do that, though. I always get into post and I'm like, oh, these the lines sound like, you know, it's really weird because, you just see the actress saying your lines and you're like, oh. I always trim quite a lot out. But I think that's just inevitable. But that's the great thing about editing. That's the thing I love about editing.
Oh yeah, I guess we do what we write it, we produce it, and then we edit it. And then the audience watch it and then decide whether it was right or wrong.
Yeah.
It's like ultimately a cruel world in the end.
Yeah.
Is it do I pronounce it Fabian Paolini Castle? Is that right?
Paolini Castle,
who plays Pearl, the daughter.
There's
a young actor playing a role that relies on a whole gamut of emotions. There's the confrontations with her, and the resistance of her mother that wants to get back with her. Plus, there's the being a teenager, growing up, and discovering you're a young woman as well at the same time, as combined with I'm guessing a little bit of the youthful rebellion of being young, basically. In terms of playing a role like that, where the actor might not have obviously, I mean, actors are obviously trying to draw on experiences and emotions they may be able to mirror in terms of what's needed for a scene. Maybe with a young actor, you've not necessarily got all of those emotions in check. So how do you balance that as a director and the actor?
I think Fab always felt like she was basing this character on her little sister, which is funny. She said that right away. She's like, she's basically my little sister. And it's like, okay, that's useful. I mean, I saw a lot of girls for that role. And the thing I liked about Fab is she's got a sort of hardness to her. There's actually, she's the sweetest person, but she can, I think there's a sort of, she doesn't let her guard down that easily. And I thought that was sort of natural with her. So, that was really useful. And as a director, I think that played quite well against the Stephanie character, who's so keen to, obviously, as you would be, to rebuild this sort of crazy, melted relationship. But yeah, I think with Fab, you know, we did a bit more rehearsal with her. You know, she wasn't obviously as experienced with as Shan and Amanda, and they just want, you know, they sort of just wanted to come and be on set and just sort of do it. You know, they don't want to spend ages rehearsing. I think they want to keep it quite fresh. So that was a little bit of a contrast, but they were all very, it was a really supportive set. They were really encouraging of her, and I think she learned a lot. But she worked really hard. She had she had a huge range of emotions and changes to go through in the story. And I think it was just a case of sort of drawing those to the surface. But, you know, it was, working with her and again, working on her character with her and getting her to understand that this is a girl that feels abandoned and is so hurt. And that's the sort of catalyst for so much of her behavior is just, and that's sort of, that does happen quite a lot with teenagers and when, you know, if there's a breakup or if whatever happens with their parents. I think there was a lot for her to connect with, and she got so much support from the other actors. So that was all really good.
Yeah, you got the sense of the way that her character had almost parked the mother as a problem that she could never solve. So therefore she was moving on with her life. And then you get this weird inverse, which is the needy mother versus the stoic daughter, which is kind of it's a weird contrast, isn't it? But it felt very real and very frightening for both of them.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, that's a really good way of putting it. It's just a bit of a role reversal of what we would expect, but it doesn't. And I think that was another nice, interesting thing about the story was it was playing with a lot of the stereotypes and flipping them around. So
and with Amanda Burton's character as the mother, you got the sense that she just wanted to bang heads and go, for goodness sake, we're going to have to sort this out. You know, this can be fixed. It can, honestly. Look, I got this far. But which obviously is underestimating the real problems that Stephanie's having to endure. But I guess in the moment when you're under your own roof and seeing interactions around a table or in a sitting room, it just feels like this is a family matter. Let's just sort it out. What were your initial conversations with Darren Bragg from a cinematography point of view? What did you cover in terms of how you wanted the look and feel to fit? The look and feel of the film in the start, you know, when you first conversation where you're already kind of beginning to see it and you're thinking, right, this is what I want it to look like. So was there any particular influence discussed or identified during that process, or was it more abstract than other films?
I hadn't worked with Darren before, and I met a lot of DOPs for this as well. And the thing I liked about Darren was he came with a bunch of books to our meeting, and he was the only person that did that, and he had, you know, earmarked certain images, and I just thought that was a really nice considered thing to do. And you know, it's just a bit different, and I think there was something about that I can't actually remember what a lot of the images were. I think he pulled up a lot of Lynn Ramsey and some nice photography and stuff like that, but that that considered way of approaching it was sort of what I wanted for this. I didn't want it to be, as I said, frenetic, up in our face, because there's so many emotions in play here that it could have been too much. I had quite a clear idea from early on in the script development about how I wanted it to look. And I was looking at references like Safe by Todd Haynes and Jean Dielman, which is this Chantal Ackerman film from the 70s.
Oh, I don't know that one.
And they both have really long takes where they let stuff play out. Unfortunately, we just didn't have there were certain things that we could do quite like that, but we didn't have quite the same scope of locations to do that. But anyway, I think so there was that, those influences trickled into it, but then there was the progression of the camera works or works in in tandem with Stephanie's mental state. So it sort of unravels a bit. Like at the beginning, it's a lot more controlled and static and away from her. And then it kind of goes a bit, gets a bit more unraveled as she unravels. So that was the language that we had developed together. But he, you know, we worked really well together. He's one of my go-to people now because he's wonderful. He's got a fantastic eye. We're just really good at sort of figuring out what emotions we wanted to get out, but where we wanted to also just let Stephanie, and it was usually Stephanie, sort of be in front of the camera and sort of show where she was at emotionally. Darren was brilliant.
You mentioned it earlier, but it was something that I really found sort of compelling about your film was that almost like that intrusive nature of the camera where obviously we're usually treated to a performance in a film. That's the point of us watching it. But in a way, there was parts of it where I felt like we were privy to something that maybe we weren't meant to be at some point. You know, there's a real edge to it.
Yeah.
How do you design that into a sequence when you're shooting it?
I think a lot of it is to do with the intimacy that we build with Stephanie over time. And that, as I said, there's like those key moments that are quite repetitive, like with her running and eating. And as they progress in the film, you know, the sound design changes and we sort of incorporate body sounds and just weird stuff that you don't normally hear. And then there's the bit in the supermarket where she sort of freaks out because she can't, like, she's just all too much. And we're sort of trained how to be in her head and how to view and how her worldview is over the course of the film. But that was a part of the collaboration, I would say. And the sound designer, I think, was a huge help in that. And she did a great job of, figuring out ways to, you know, it's quite, if you listen to the soundtrack as much as I have, obviously, like the layers of those body noises and stuff, like it really sets your teeth on edge.
No, I was fully headphoned in. So yes. It gets to you. I watched Picnic at Hanging Rock recently, and which is obviously a very strong period drama. But it's interesting how sound design elevates that to almost like horror. You're beginning to feel on edge, like you're watching a horror film. And in a sense, that was part of Body of Water, is that yes, we are watching a family drama as they fall apart from each other, but actually, the turmoil that Stephanie's going through is in addition to that breakdown of the family, and so that has to sound like you've added to the film.
It's definitely flirted with horror. I think at some points it would have gone more further down the horror route, because I was quite inspired by certain body horror films. Like there's a French film called In My Skin from the 90s, I think, and it's one of these, I can't remember the director's name, but basically it's about a woman who has an accident and she's sort of hurts her leg, but then she becomes kind of obsessed with the wound and then she sort of starts to eat herself. I know that sounds really disgusting. So
it sounds like a film I should see, to be honest with you.
I think you definitely should see it because it's great if you like that kind of body horror stuff. And I thought it was like, I wanted to love Raw and I just didn't. But In Her Skin is like so much better than Raw, but it's sort of in that world. There's drafts that definitely pushed it further down that route. But in the end, the film became a bit more poetic, I suppose. And that was a lot to do with the sensitivity of the performance and what we were able to do. It's just interesting, like how the development process can kind of change a film or not, or whatever it does. Because it did go down those routes, and it definitely went down a few, dead ends.
Over the last few years, Safe has certainly been reappraised as a horror film.
Absolutely.
You know, even though there's barely a visceral moment on screen, but it's obviously a nightmare.
The bit where she gets the nosebleed, I always remember that quite vividly from Safe. I mean, it's just stunning, and all everything
that's not white, I suppose, is going to be like, oh my god, you know, it's really visceral, isn't it? Because it's such a blank canvas of a film, isn't it? For so much of it.
Yeah, it's so clean, and her sort of. Like her sort of out of body performance is quite, you know, it's very intense and love that film.
Yeah, more appreciation for Safe is needed.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but obviously, Body of Water is in reference to the seaside location, but obviously, Body of Water is obviously we are made up of water as a majority of what we are. But obviously, we need food to function, which I guess is a part of maybe what you're trying to communicate there. But the look and feel of it is being a British seaside town is quintessentially British. You know, you can differentiate the location from its European or its American counterparts. And being what appears to be out of season, or obviously not a kind of, it's certainly not a Clacton-on-Sea sort of seaside location. So it's not like, you know, the bright lights are just turned off for the winter or anything. But that gives it a kind of sleepiness to. In the mood of the place, like we're waiting for something, you know, like a town that's waiting for something to happen, which is in a way, and I might be overthinking this, but, you know, in the sense of that's kind of what Stephanie's kind of waiting for, this moment to happen where she can live, and it's never quite happening. But why a seaside town is what I'm jumping around the houses for there.
I was interested in Canvey because I have a couple of family members live in that area.
Okay.
And the wall in it, I don't know that the wall appears quite a lot. And I think that was quite an interesting binding tool because, it was quite easy to build a sense of characters, you know, regular places because there's this very distinctive wall. And it's somewhere I hadn't seen so much, but also maybe it's probably a bit cliched, but like the idea of the sea and the sort of open, you know, the openness of it, the possibility of it, but also the power and terror of it is something that, you know, is enduringly fascinating. So I'm not the first person and I won't be the last that thought, you know, it would be beautiful to be able to integrate that. But exactly as you said, like all the thinking, you know, the film was called Sicker for a long time.
Okay.
And that definitely evokes a lot more of a horror type vibe, I would say, or sensibility. It was really after we did the picture, we looked at the picture, like, you know what, I just don't think that that title just doesn't suit the film anymore. So I was reading some poetry, as one does. I was reading a poem.
And it's all you can do, really, unless you're writing it.
I know, yeah, it's true. I'm aware that, you know, I just hear my Scottish relatives being like, what? Who do you think, you know? A bit poncy that. But anyway, so I was reading some poetry and I saw the line about something, a line about body of water, and I thought, that is really, it's a lovely phrase and it just has so many meanings. Mm. And obviously, in the context of this, it's like, well, yeah, as you said, her body, you know, our bodies are made up of these elements. And in order to flourish, you know, we are doing this animal thing, but then she's basically rejecting being an animal and she's rejecting all of these natural things. And also it's making her, you know, it's driven this wedge between her and her daughter, which is another of the most natural kind of relationships. So it really seemed like a lovely kind of summation of that. The landscape and so on, and the end, which I don't want to necessarily give away, but it sort of touched on so many of those things. The landscape, I think, was something that I think good stories have a sense of their place and that feeds into the characters. And you're right. I think it was sort of, this sleepiness, this sort of bore, you know, that like the thing, like Pearl being a bit bored and sort of going around with their own kind of guys and, you know, not really having a lot to do.
Have you seen Andrew Hume's film, The Devil Inside?
No, but I've heard of it.
Which is set in suburbia in Mansfield. And when I interviewed him about it, I said that it captures a mundanity, which sounds like a criticism, but actually that is a facet of British life, because not all of it is Piccadilly Circus, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, you know, those kinds of places, I think, when they're a bit quieter and, it, there's some really dark stuff going on. I think that film County Lines was set in Canvey as well.
Yes, it does.
So Canvey now seems to be a hotbed for film production. But actually, the nice thing also about shooting there, just on a practical level, was that they were so accommodating and lovely because they just weren't as jaded and sick of seeing film, you know, indie filmmakers as people in London, you know. So they were like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, they gave us really good deals and it was like, and like, you know, it was nice for the community to have a film going on. And so that was a nice thing about it, I have to say.
My final question is a bit cheesy, and it's one I sort of have to ask when people come on with first features. And for the filmmaker listening who hasn't gone and made their feature yet, what's a lesson learned that you think you're going to be taking forward into other productions that you got from a feature film that you hadn't got from other shorter productions you'd worked on in the past?
There's a few things I think I would take away from making this. One is, you know, being patient, but striking the right balance between being patient and also being tenacious and not taking any nonsense, because there's a lot of first features that don't end up getting made and that fall down, and we all, you know, films fall down in development all the time, and obviously no one wants to be one of those. So I think on the whole had really good collaborative relationships. So picking the right people and making sure you trust those people, because it's going to get gnarly, even if it doesn't seem like it's going to get gnarly. And I think I know myself a lot better, and I think I'm going to be a lot less sensitive about, you know, I think it's normal to be quite sensitive, especially when you're writing about subjects that are close to your heart or you feel come from a personal place.
Yeah.
But I think just making sure that I kind of keep a bit of separation and I'm not so emotionally invested in it, because that made it hard to step away sometimes, and it can't not. And, you know, I think that also made me push it forward and get it made, but it also made it hard to kind of put it to one side sometimes. So it can become a bit all consuming. And I know that's the same for, so it's sort of finding the balance really. But that's much easier said than done, especially if, and you know, you need to care, like you need to love the project more than anyone else. So I think committing to projects that you love, but also finding a balance and sort of trying to develop a couple of the things that you know at the same time, just to sort of keep yourself a bit balanced about it, is probably the best thing. And picking the right collaborators, always, because you're going to be with these people for a long time.
I can well understand. Well, look. Thank you very much for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
Some of you might remember Stephanie. She was last with us 4 or 5 years ago.
Get me a copy of your eating plan.
So good to see you.
Mom, will you speak to her for me?
You've got to try a bit.
Why has it got to be my problem?
Because you're her daughter. That's a precious thing.
This is Sean, my nurse.
Hiya.
Hi.
Seven months I was there.
Didn't think about coming to see me.
I had this picture of how perfect it was going to be when I got out.
I just wanted to talk to you.
I don't want to. I'm not like you. I'm not a victim.
She is still my daughter.
You were never there. Is that what you like? To play hero?
You must be strong.
I'm tired of being strong.
I'd rather be the sick one, because then at least I'd know where I am.
You know, this is going nowhere but down.
You're not fit to be a parent.
Do you want to end up like her?
No.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.